Hello and welcome to the Thinking Poker Podcast. I'm Andrew Brokus, and with me as always is Nate Mavis. How are we doing today, Nate?
Doing great. How are you? Back from Atlantic City, safe and sound, I trust?
Yeah, I'm back Atlantic City, and then ended up making a last-minute stop off in outside of Baltimore as well to see my family for Thanksgiving, kind of a last-minute decision to do that. But yeah, it's been good.
Excellent. I got about this close to joining you in Atlantic City, not least because I have some comps that are going to expire late in January. So,
yeah, how? I mean, you don't seem like a guy who's really into playing minus EV pick games, and I know that you're not getting shit for comps from playing poker. How are you ending up with comp points that you need to burn?
Yeah, I mean, this is the Nitcast, right? But sometimes, I mean, nittiness also includes squeaking out every dollar you can at the casino. So I play slots promotions. So my biggest score last summer was actually at a slots promotion at the Trop. But more frequently, I begin every day that I'm at a casino by going and playing very small stakes video poker so that I can get my coffee comped. Because I mean the expectation. So if I run, I have to run maybe $5 or $10 through the video poker machine while I'm having my two cups of coffee, and I don't play perfectly. I probably lose 5% of that money, but 50 cents for two cups of coffee is a lot better than anything else you can do in the casino. And I'm getting better at video poker. So,
well, and you're tipping the waitresses too, though, right?
Yeah, but that's a wash. So, I mean, most of the other places I can get coffee would also involve tipping the bartender. So if you want to call it $2.50 as opposed to the $5 or $8 I would spend at Starbucks.
Starbucks isn't that expensive. Just to get like a large coffee.
I think I have spent.
You don't pay $8 for a large coffee at Starbucks.
I was saying two large coffees.
You would get two, like, I don't know what they're big, grande coffees. Two venti coffees for breakfast?
One then, one later. Maybe I would only get one very large
coffee. You have a problem, sir.
Really?
That's a lot of coffee. I mean, do you drink coffee later in the day too?
I caffeinate myself from up until about 2 p.m. This is different in Las Vegas when I'm keeping gambler's hours, but I...
Yeah, that's a lot of caffeine.
Yeah, I start, well, at home I start my day with a double strength coffee, and then I have a few cups of caffeinated tea after that, like through lunch. Too much caffeine?
It strikes me as a lot in the morning. Just, I mean, the venti coffee is a lot of coffee.
Yeah.
I used to work in a 7-Eleven. Like, we would have people come in with, like, you could get a refill for 50 cents for whatever your container was. So, I mean, we would have people come in with, like, giant mugs and fill them up multiple times over the day. But I always thought it was disgusting that people were drinking that much.
Really? You're right that I wouldn't – my calculation was off. Like, I would only have one venti coffee and then probably some bit of – caffeine later, or a couple cups of tea later, or something like
that's more reasonable. If you felt the need to be drinking like 48 ounces of coffee just to wake up in the morning, I would consider that a lot.
Yeah, no, that's not something. But I do get a lot of caffeine. I'm definitely addicted to it. I just don't really care that I'm addicted to it, because as far as I can tell, like, even my doctor is telling me this, like, if it's not hurting my sleep, it's not hurting me at all. I don't really buy those studies that come out about everything, that it might cure cancer or whatever. But as far as I can tell, scientific consensus is that being addicted to caffeine in and of itself is neither good nor bad. Yeah.
Yeah, it's certainly pleasurable.
Yeah, it's nice.
All right, so anyway, you're saving, like, the venti coffee would be, I don't know, the Starbucks in the casinos are actually pretty expensive.
Yeah.
So I guess it would probably be like $3 to $4. Is it $5?
If you put your change in the tip jar, I think it is. I would say
so. I guess $5 versus you're paying $2.50 at the
$2.50 maybe plus.
Plus you get the thrill of playing video poker.
Yeah, I get a little bit of action. I think it helps me get hotel comps. I don't know exactly how this works, but I think even $10 of action a day helps out a little bit. And I certainly have hotel offers from Harrah's now, and I think they're better than what I would get if I just gave them poker action.
Yeah, I guess part of what they're banking on is they're not just looking at your current level of play, but they're hoping to elevate your level of play. Right. So they're not like you're not getting those offers based on like the hopes that you'll play $10 a day. You're getting those offers on the hopes that, you know, some percentage of their $10 a day players at some point convert to $100 or $500 a day players.
Yeah, exactly. And if I'm a little bit of a fish about something, it's not bringing a lot of other food with me on gambling trips. So they definitely sell overpriced food and other kinds of things to me while I'm staying in one of their hotels. So,
Yeah, my preferred method of knitting it up is just to travel with my own food and coffee to the extent that I'm able.
yeah.
So I, you know, I've got a mug with a built-in French press. So if I and I can bring my own coffee, so I just need to find a source of hot water, which often you can beg from the Starbucks without having to pay much or maybe, you know, tip the person $1 and get some hot water, and then you can be drinking your own coffee, which is at least mine of far better quality than what I get from Starbucks anyway.
Yeah, well, we should combine our powers then the next time we're on a gambling trip together.
Yeah, because I think that the gaming the comp systems and the free drinks at the video poker machine only works if you really don't have any inclination to continue playing. I mean, I think they would, I'm sure, be perfectly fine knowing that you're doing this, with the understanding that like some percentage of people who do it can't actually stop when they finish drinking the coffee. You know, they have it in their head that they're going to try to get even, or they're enjoying it and they're going to keep playing more, or something along those lines.
And if you look like I do, even if you're 29 years old and feel like a grizzled veteran of Las Vegas, and if you sort of awkwardly slide into the last seat on a video poker bar, and if you order something non-alcoholic, and if you start playing video poker, you will get carded so fast and so often you won't even know what to do. I have taken just to sitting down at the bar, taking my ID out and giving it to them before they ask, because I will get carded every single time. I guess it's what underage people do.
Just because they think they're less likely to get carded if they're not drinking alcohol.
It's got to be, I
Yeah, that makes
think.
sense.
Yeah. Or else maybe I don't have like a theory of this. I just know it happens like every last time. Well, speaking of combining our powers, we should talk about strategy, huh?
Yeah, we've got an email this week.
It's from I don't know if he wants us to out his real name. It's from a
We
gentleman
can
named.
say John. I think that's generic enough. No one will.
Yeah, that's right. Well, a Mr. JB Patzer posted this online, and he's a listener and a nice guy.
So this is a hand that he played at a $1, $2 table. And do you know, was this on PokerStars? Do you know
I
sites?
don't know. I
Okay.
don't think it. Full tilt.
Okay. So Full Tilt back in action. JB Patzer is an early readopter.
Crazy.
$1, $2 table, and he is in the big blind with Jack 10 offsuit. So action folds to the player in the small blind, who raises to $6. And our listener chooses to call $4 more and see a flop. Does that sound right to you?
Yes, I think that's right. We should probably note that there's almost no history with this person, and the stacks are 100 big blinds deep.
Yeah, I don't think there's much sense in. In fact, I think this is a pretty bad hand to three bet, because if you do three bet with this hand, you're going to end up, when you do see a flop, I don't think you're going to be able to play the hand real strongly when you flop top pair. I mean, in all likelihood, you're going to be outkicked when you get top pair. In a single raise pot, I mean, that's at least somewhat less likely. Your opponent's going to have a lot more weaker hands in his range, and you can feel a little more confident flopping top pair. But my general rule is if I'm not going to be able to play top pair strongly when I three bet a hand like this, then I'm not going to three bet it.
I think that's right. Obviously, we could talk all day about exceptions to that three betting rule you just listed,
Yeah, it's a very general thing, but
but in this situation, blind blind in the big blind, I don't want to put Jack 10 offsuit standardly in my three betting range unless I have some very interesting reason, just because there are some of those issues we talked about with Ben about how Jack 10 is in some ways just a worse version of what it looks like you might have if you three
right.
bet, and also because it plays well just by calling. So it's like you're giving up something good for something that's not very good at all. I would rather put a hand like Queen 8 into my re-raising range if I wanted to smooth it out like that a little bit.
Yeah, and I think it's certainly a hand you want to call with. I think folding this, the small blind would have to be the world's biggest nit for me to think about folding this.
Yeah, that would be criminal.
It's just, I mean, it's a nice hand. You're going to have position, you're getting decent pot odds, and his range is probably relatively wide. So I think this is a real standard call. Not a lot controversial there.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes you flop top pair, like
Yeah.
Johnny does. It comes a 10-3 deuce rainbow. There's $12 in the pot. The small blind bets out 7 into 12, and our hero here decides to raise to $22. What do you think of that?
I'm not thrilled about it. I mean, it's one of these cases where you're really likely to have the best hand, just having flopped top pair in a blind battle. You're real likely to have the best hand, but I don't see a lot of second best hands that are going to be paying you off when you raise.
Yeah.
Once you raise, what you're essentially doing is inviting your opponent. Like, the only way you're going to continue to get action is if your opponent is bluffing. Or, I mean, there's a few circumstances, like maybe he has 9-10, maybe he has 8-10, maybe he has ace 3. I'm not saying there are no hands out there that can pay you off, but especially if he raises again, you're essentially putting yourself in, you're turning a pretty good hand into a bluff catcher. And this may be a decent way to induce a bluff by raising on a flop like this, because it is a really dry flop. It is a spot where both players are, each player knows that both players have really wide ranges and that his opponent knows that. I mean, there's a lot of like bullshitting that goes back and forth. So raising with top pair can be a decent way to induce action from your opponent. But here, I think the top pair is just not quite strong enough. We don't have a lot of history with this particular player, and I still think you can represent a pretty wide range just by calling. I mean, this is also a very good flop to float.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also a good flop to call with ace high because you have ace high and position and it could be the best hand. And I think if your
Yeah.
calling range is going to have ace high in it, it's good to put some top pair in there also. So
Yeah.
I think that's another reason to call. I'm not sure exactly what my calling and raising ranges look like here, but I would not want a calling range without any top pair or without much top pair here.
Yeah. Even if you were to raise, I think, like I was saying, the only reason to raise really would be to try to represent a bluff and get your opponent to either, try to rebluff you or just appeal very light. And if I were doing that, I'd want to raise a lot smaller than this. So in this case, the small blind bet 7 and hero raised to 22. And I think I would more likely raise to like 15, just, practically a minimum raise, something that's going to look really, really bluffy.
Yeah, I think.
And give him room to play back. I mean, this makes it pretty expensive for villain to play back.
Yeah, that's right. And obviously, it'll make your bluffs cheaper too if you're raising to 15. I would make it a little bit more, but I'm not sure I have good reason for doing that. Just stating a fact, I would probably make it 17 with
Yeah.
my inducing range and my pure bluffs and all these things.
Yeah. The other thing, I'd actually probably be more inclined to raise here if, like, let's say the flop was 7-3-2 and I had 7-6,
Yeah.
I'd be more inclined to raise that kind of top pair hand because it's really vulnerable. And so getting villain to fold even like an air hand like 10-9 would be valuable because that hits a hand that has six outs against us. The higher your pair is, the less inclined I think you need to be to raise it for protection. So when I raise the 7-6, it's mostly as protection because almost any card is potentially bad for my hand. When you have a top pair and you also have an overcard as a kicker, that's a lot less likely to be true. I mean, yeah, aces, kings, queens are still not ideal cards, but that's a lot less than half the deck.
Yeah, exactly. And one thing you mentioned that I think people don't consider often enough is what their kicker is, not just the height of the height, not just the value of their pair, but also that because they have a jack kicker, a lot of his hands that are over cards to the 10, you have reverse dominated now. So,
Yeah, ace, jack, king, jack, queen, jack. I mean, those kind of hands, if a jack turns, that's a bonanza for you.
yeah. And I think he's raising all those
Yeah,
100%
absolutely.
of the time from, I mean, that's a big part of his range.
Yeah, I mean, what ends up happening here and gets our hero into a bad spot is the small blind does three bet him. So it starts off small blind bet 7, hero makes it 22, and then small blind makes it 56.
Right.
And at this point, I'm feeling pretty uncomfortable about the hand, which is why I don't like raising the flop. I mean, you generally want to avoid spots where you want to avoid raising if you're not going to have an easy decision to a three bet. Yes. It doesn't mean you can't raise a hand that can't stand a three bet. I mean, your easy decision might just be that it's an easy fold if you get three bet. But here, we feel like the hand is, I mean, it's a pretty good hand. You're not real wild about folding top pair with a decent kicker in a blind battle. But it's also like he's not three betting a worse hand for value. So now you've done what I was talking about. You've turned your hand into a bluff catcher.
And it matters a lot that the flop is 10-3 deuce, not 10-6-5 or 10-5-4, just because I think a lot of people fold 5-4 offsuit before the flop, so he can't really have many draws either. There's no flush draw here. The board's rainbow. So he really, I mean, what does he have? He's got a better hand than you or what?
Yeah, or just, you know, some random hand that he's bluffing with. Yeah. And this is not a way that a lot of people, I think, especially in just in general, this is not a real common sort of bluff.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I would have a hard time folding for 34 more, but at the same time, maybe this is the time to fold if you're going to.
I mean, like I say, the real central problem is I don't want to raise and then not know what to do if I get three bets. I mean, if I raised, it would most likely be because I knew my opponent was like really bluffy and I was hoping to induce a three bet or something.
Yeah.
So I kind of don't. It's hard for me to say what I would do in this spot because the first answer is avoid it.
Yeah.
Given that, I mean, there are certainly opponents against him, I would suggest just folding.
Yeah, I think that's right. I generally am skeptical of hand analyses that say, look, you're in an uncomfortable spot, so you must have done something wrong to get there. I mean, I think you really, if you're not thinking about it, you unbalance a lot of your ranges and you miss a lot of good lines if you reason like that. But this really is a spot where I think, look, this is one reason why you really ought to think twice about raising this flop. But our hero calls. He calls the 34. There's 124 in the pot going to the turn, which pairs the deuce and puts up a backdoor flush draw. So we have 10-3 deuce deuce. Backdoor flush draw, 124 in the pot, and now the small blind leads out for $35 into 124.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, you're getting pretty good odds. On the other hand, it sure as shit looks like he's just bleeding you. Yeah. I mean, he's only got 140 left in the effective stacks, so it's going to be trivial. I mean, you've really got to think of this. You've got to assume with a lot of likelihood that last $100 is going in on the river.
Yeah.
And you need to have a plan for that. Again, it doesn't have to mean, like, it's not, you know, you have to call the river if you call the turn, and it's not, you have to fold the river if you call the turn, but you have to know which one you're going to do before you call the turn. You don't want to call the turn and then just say, oh, you know, we'll see what happens on the river, because there's almost no circumstance where I think the river card is going to be meaningful here.
You sometimes see people try.
A 10, I guess.
Yeah. you sometimes see people try to set their own price with a draw, but again, it's hard to see what draws he could have here.
Yeah, I mean, without the flush draw on the flop, I don't think the backdoor flush draw is real significant. You know, I guess there's some outside chance that he was making some spazzy bluff on the flop and now he turned a flush draw, but that doesn't, I don't think that's too likely.
Yeah, I mean, he could have like 6-5 suited, maybe. He might play exactly 6-5 of spades like this sometimes, but I agree that we shouldn't be thinking of flush draws as a big part of his range.
Yeah, so I mean, you're still in just in that bluff catching mode, and the one thing I don't like here is raising.
That's right.
Like I think shoving here is just your hand is not that vulnerable if you are ahead. So like driving out, even though it's kind of a large pot at this point, I think just like driving out a hand that you're ahead of is not very valuable. So the only way you're going to get value from this hand is by picking off bluffs. So you just have to call here and then make a decision on the river if you choose to call here. I also think I think I would probably fold at this point if I didn't fold the flop. I think the fact that we called the flop is, I just don't think there's any chance that Villain expects Hero to fold to the turn bet. Once Hero has called the flop, I think it's extremely unlikely that Villain expects him to fold on a virtual blank on the turn for a quarter of the pot. And based on that, I don't see how he can have a hand worse than Jack 10.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm not sure I would find a fold here, but it sure makes sense. How likely would you think a river shove is after this kind of a turn bet? Like, given that the turn goes bet call and there's roughly a half pot left on the river, how likely do you think a shove is to be coming?
85%.
All right. that makes me like a fold more.
Yeah, I don't see how it's not coming.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you could imagine you spike a 10 sometimes, river goes check, check sometimes. It's not that hard to justify calling a 30% pot bet on the turn with top pair in a blind battle, but I can definitely see the argument for folding here.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a case, I don't want to say pot odds don't matter, but it's not like you're drawing to anything. It's not like he's drawing to anything. Like, what really matters is the frequency with which he's bluffing.
Yeah.
It's not a matter of equity in terms of cards to come. It's really just a matter of, you either are way ahead or way behind. And I think the way behind is a lot more likely based on this betting line. I mean, so there are certain people who will make like these real small bets as sort of like blocking bets when they have top pair.
Yeah.
But those same people don't three bet the flop with top pair. You know, so if villain happens to be the sort of person who would play like 10-8, where he would bet a quarter of the pot with 10-8 on the turn, I don't think that same person three bets 10-8 on the flop.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I mean, I just think it's really clear. There's actually a hand, this is a real old hand. I believe it was posted by Gigabet, who was kind of a legendary 2+2 poster back in the day. I believe it was a hand between him and Eric Haber Sheets. The two of them, it was a blind battle hand, and Gigabet was in the small blind, and he flopped two pair. So he bet and three bet the flop, and Eric called, and then Gigabet checked and folded to a bet on the turn. And his reasoning was that he thought Eric's flop calling range was going to consist of either hands that would be trying to get to showdown cheaply after calling a three bet, and hands that would be trying to build the pot. And hands that were trying to build the pot were all hands better than I think Gigabet had bottom two.
Yeah.
So he thought once he had three bet the flop, Eric was either going to check the turn with hands that were behind Gigabet's two pair, or Eric was, if Eric continued trying to build the pot, it would be an indication that bottom two was no good. And I think that's kind of the same thing we're seeing here. Like, once there's been this much action on the flop, if villain is still interested in building the pot, I don't see how top pair can be good. And I think the fact that you're getting really good pot odds on the turn is deceptive, because nothing is going to change on the river, at least a very large percentage of the time. It's not going to change nearly often enough on the river. Even if you hit a jack, it's far from a guarantee that you're going to be good. I would certainly be calling an all-in on the river if I hit a jack, but I think that's really more of a – that would be because of the pot odds, not because I thought I was, like, well ahead.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I could reminisce about Gigabet posts with you all day. I, at one point in my life, had – one of them printed out and put on my wall above my computer. And I can actually literally remember where I was when I read several of Gigabet's posts. They were just a huge influence on me, and it was very exciting.
It was kind of a combination of like really smart stuff and also sort of like quasi mystical stuff. I mean, yeah. I think part of the appeal of him was he was offering this idea that there was an element. A lot of situations, like he started off as a sit and go player, which a lot of listeners probably know is a very, very mechanical game. Sit and goes are maybe not entirely solved, but like relatively close to solved. And a lot of the situations are really solidly dictated by math. And so Gigabet played in a somewhat unconventional way. And I think probably not as much as his post would indicate, because he only posted about like really crazy stuff that he did in rare circumstances.
Yeah.
But he gave the impression that there was more room for creativity than there probably is in sit and goes. And on the one hand, in other forms of poker, there is some room for creativity, and his posts were good at cultivating that. But I also think they probably to some extent overstated the case, and it was very appealing to, at the time, you know, novice player like myself, to read something like this and to think that you could kind of leapfrog your way ahead in poker strategy by mastering this non-mathematical mysticism that Gigabet was offering.
Yeah, but at the same time, there was all this really solid strategy. I mean, part of the mystique was this quasi-mystical aspect, and then after a while, these rumors started swirling about him maybe having lied about some stuff, maybe being scummy in certain ways, maybe being not as big of a winner as people thought. And the whole thing, it became this like phenomenon, but I still found incredible value in these posts. And I mean, I still sort of recite to myself lines from some of those sometimes, like, what's your opponent thinking? He must be thinking something, you know? I mean, it sounds simple, but you put it in that way and it's useful. But
like a lot of prophets, he turned out to have a little bit of a huckster in him as well.
Yeah, and like a lot of religious literature, often the best thing to do is to put aside questions of the spiritual authority of the author and just get what you can out of the text, you know?
Yeah.
But he advised making some good folds sometimes. And I think this might be a good gigabit-ish fold to make here on the turn. But our hero does not make the fold on the turn. He calls the 35, puts 194 in the pot on the river. And now the small blind, as expected roughly 85% of the time, bets all in. And here we are. But the river pairs the three, which is a bit of a twist. A little bit of a twist, at least.
A little bit. Yeah.
10-3, deuce, deuce, three.
I mean, I suppose that's a good card in the sense that it makes set less likely.
Yeah.
I mean, with now two twos and two threes on the board, it's less likely that you're up against a full house.
Yeah.
Which might seem weird to people, because it seems like with two pairs on the board, full houses become a lot more likely. Yeah. But I don't really see villain having three bet the flop with a lone deuce or a lone tray in his hand.
Yeah.
So I think that the cards on the board, I mean, if he was three betting the flop, it was with a two or three, he most likely had two of them for a set.
Yeah.
So I think that the fact now that there's only one combo of pocket twos and one combo of pocket threes actually makes it less likely that that's the hand he had initially.
Absolutely. And especially maybe if he had a deuce, he would underbet the turn. But I think if he bet the turn with a three, he'd be trying to get hero to fold a little bit more.
Yeah.
I think when I read this hand the first time, I came around to thinking that this was a river fold. I didn't decide on a turn fold, although now I'm pretty convinced, I think. But for me, the key to this hand is something pretty clear, which is that hero's hand looks almost exactly like what it is. I think rightly or wrongly, your opponent will suspect you have roughly a hand like this. And so he should think that you're going to check behind a lot. I think you're getting value bet here by so many of the hands that are better than Jack 10. Even a hand like King 10 could value shove this river.
Yeah, I was going to say King 10 is probably the bottom of the hands I would see this playing this way, like Ace 10 or King 10. But all the way up through aces, I think, are all very plausible. I do think that deuce tray or pocket threes or pocket twos are now a lot less likely with the way the board has run out. But I still think, like, I don't think that polarizes his range that much. Or I think that upper pole of his range, the pole of hands that are better than yours, can go down pretty deep all the way to hands like you're saying, King 10 and Ace 10.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right.
So yeah, he can just be value betting all kind of stuff here. And even if you can find an excuse why he might occasionally show up with a bluff, it's not enough to make up for the number of value combinations that are possible for him.
Yeah, and John did call here. And he got shown King Queen offsuit for nothing. So John ended up winning this pot. And after I found that out, I started to wonder if I had maybe underemphasized, you know, I kept on saying that there weren't any draws in his range, or at least not many. And I started to wonder if maybe I had been insufficiently sensitive to the presence of these six out quote unquote draws. Of course, the reverse domination thing we talked about earlier qualifies that a little bit. I think, all things considered, I still like a river fold, but do you think there was an error in my analysis all along?
Well, I think that there are, I don't want to make a call assuming that an unknown opponent is doing something like this. You know, I kind of hinted in when I was discussing a flop raise that there certainly are, there is a type of player who will three bet the flop with that kind of hand and barrel off with it, but not knowing that villain is that type of player, I don't assume that a default player is going to do that. So when I have no history with a guy, I think it's pretty ambitious to think that even in a blind battle that I'm going to be able to induce a flop three bet bluff and then get him to barrel off on the turn in the river. So I wouldn't make this play unless I was anticipating something like this happening.
Okay.
And I'd need to have a good reason for it. some opponent specific read, and this is not the default way that I would want to play this hand without knowing anything about my opponent.
Sounds good. I think ultimately that's where I come down, but I do just self-critically think that I didn't include overcard draws in the set of possible draws the way that I maybe should have. So I think that's something that people sometimes get wrong at the table, especially sort of in the heat of the moment. It's a way that people sort of at the table thinking diverges from their sitting at their desk in the study in front of a microphone, so to speak, reasoning does, is that when they think about draws, they look at the obvious draws and they don't think about some of their, you know, how like a pair and a kicker can be a 5-out draw or overcards can be a 6-out draw. And I think it's important to be sensitive about those things. And yeah, I tried to be good about that, but I think I lost track of that a little bit here. So that's a lesson I'm going to take going forward.
Well, I'm just happy for John that he won the pot.
Yeah. Don't spend it all in one spot, John. So
good for you, John.
So we've got Lee coming up here now. He's waiting in the green room.
Yeah, well, speaking of legends of the early days of online poker,
yeah.
Lee Jones.
Yeah, it'd be like sort of opposite the Gigabet quasi-mystical figure. Lee is just this sensible uncle figure. He's just like all good sense and reason, it seems to me.
And reliability. You know, I think that Lee has a lot to do. I mean, Lee was like the public face of PokerStars for a while. I mean, he was the poker room manager at PokerStars, and we'll talk a little bit more with Lee about his history with PokerStars and when he got started off there. But even at a time when nobody knew the name Isai Scheinberg, who's the owner of PokerStars, Lee Jones was really the public face of PokerStars. Like, he was the guy who was posting on 2+2. He was hosting Sunday Million Final Tables. And the fact that he was such a forthright, stand-up, likable, respected guy who had a history in the poker community even before his involvement with PokerStars, I think had a lot to do with PokerStars building up the sort of legitimacy that it continues to enjoy today. And we see PokerStars continuing to do things like buying up Full Tilt and refunding money to American players so quickly after Black Friday. I mean, PokerStars has certainly done things on its own. I mean, taken actions to establish that solid reputation as well. But I think having a spokesperson with the kind of reputation and character that Lee has was really important in the early days when online poker had an even more shady reputation than it has in contemporary times, when no one really knew PokerStars from any other site and everyone was a little nervous about having money online, knowing that it was in the hands, not that it was literally in Lee's hands, I hope, but knowing that it was figuratively in the hands of the sort of company that would employ Lee Jones, I think was very reassuring for a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. I think anyone who's been around for a while can remember all sorts of cases of Lee acting with a lot of class in a public way. And, you know, he's that nice pretty much all the time I've seen him, which is not a ton, but it's been very kind leading up to this interview, and I played some Palom at Omaha with him at the PCA a couple years ago.
I'm jealous. I've never met him in person.
Yeah, he's that awesome over the table. And I mean, it was Omaha, so it involved a bit of luck, of course, like everything in Omaha does. But yeah, I have stacked Lee Jones, and so I feel really proud of that. I mean, it's not because stacking somebody once at Omaha means anyway, but just sort of in a achievement unlocked, you know, resume line kind of way.
Yeah, the bucket list.
Yeah. It was fun. And he's exactly the kind of guy you want at your poker table.
Or on your podcast.
Yeah, or on your podcast. And sometimes when people say that, they mean that the other person's a fish. I mean, Lee is decidedly not a fish. He's just an awesome guy to hang out at the table with and play some cards with. So,
all right, well, let's bring him out here. Our guest today is the man, the myth, the legend, Lee Jones. Lee has been around online poker since the very earliest days, first as a Usenet participant, later as poker room manager for PokerStars. He spent a few years at Card Runners, and now he's back at PokerStars in an ever-evolving role. Thanks for coming on the show, Lee. Let's start with PokerStars. How did your job there come about?
So I was working away in Silicon Valley, minding my own business. And, you know, I had written that stupid little book, and it wasn't, I mean, it wasn't really doing anything. I mean, I was getting a royalty check for like, you know, $200 or $300 once a quarter, you know, playing 3/6 and 6/12 limit hold'em at, I guess by then I was probably playing 20/40, at Garden City A101 in San Jose. And I got a email from my publisher who said that PokerStars wanted to talk to me. And I guess this was right after Chris Moneymaker had won, right? Mm-hmm. And I was sort of like moderately aware of that, but I wasn't really into the whole poker scene that much. But he said PokerStars wanted to talk to me, and I thought, you know, they want me to sign some books, or, you know, want to buy my, you know, want to put my book in their store, you know, whatever it is. And then the next thing I know, I get a call from the head of PokerStars. And I guess at this point in time, I can actually use the name Esai Scheinberg instead of, you know, it was Esai on the phone. And, you know, 5 minutes in the conversation, it strikes me that he's actually talking about a job. and I can remember, you know, I can remember standing in the parking lot of the company that I worked for with my, you know, sort of brick sized cell phone, looking at the cell phone going like, what? A software engineer in Silicon Valley. There's been some awful misunderstanding. But the more he talked about it, I was like, wow, a job in poker, you know? And after some amount of discussion and, you know, negotiations, and he kind of auditioned to me some about it, gave me some projects to work on. And it was like, okay, want to come work for us? I was like, yeah, sure. It's crazy. What the heck? The weird thing is that maybe 3 weeks before Esai called me, I had reached my 25-year anniversary in the computer business. I actually joined IBM 25 years prior to that date, 3 weeks ago or something, right?
Wow.
And yeah, it was kind of like, wow, that's been a long time. So then when that happened, I thought maybe this is some kind of, you know, message from God that I'm supposed to have a career change, but who knew, right?
What did he have to tell you to convince you to come on board? I mean, it seems like you thought this was crazy when he first started talking to you.
Well, no, I mean, it wasn't that he had to say something in particular. I mean, at first I thought, well, you know, what kind of salary is he going to offer me? And, you know, one thing that's really, what's really funny is that when we started discussing salary, he was like, well, what do you think you should get paid? And I said, well, what do you think you should pay me?
And then, poker player, always looking for position.
Right. I started laughing. I was literally laughing out loud because I thought, oh my God, two poker players and we both want the button, right?
Right.
So I thought, okay, somebody's got to go first here. We're never going to make any progress. So I just told him what I was getting paid, you know, in Silicon Valley. And he said, okay, you know, that's interesting. And then, like, when he came back with an offer, it was basically exactly what I was getting paid in my, you know, day job. And I thought, okay, well, you know, the money's to a first approximation the same. So, no, I mean, it was just, it wasn't like he had to really persuade me. I kind of went, you know, this might be crazy, but wow. And I have to say that one thing, and he's not listening and he'll probably never hear about this, but there's a guy, and if somehow this can get back to him, I would be really happy. There's a guy named Matt Crowley, and that was the vice president of the company that I was working for at the time in Santa Clara, California. So if you work in Silicon Valley and you know Matt Crowley, please tell him that I mentioned his name. I went and I told the boss that I was going to leave. And, you know, a few hours or the next day or whatever, Matt came around my cube and said, come, let's go for a walk. And we went out walking along the levees in Santa Clara. And basically the first thing he said was, look, you know, you're obviously going on this massive career change and, you know, all this other stuff. And he said, I hope we never see you again, but if you ever need to come back, you have a job here.
That's good security to have.
And it was just the most wonderful, calming thing I possibly could have heard at that moment. And wow. I've never forgotten that. And one of these days I need to track that Matt down on LinkedIn or something and say, you know, it was just something that I really needed to hear. Cause I had a wife and kids stuff, you know, just like, you know, I'm going to work for this guy I've never met in a business. It's, you know, some people consider a little dodgy. So yeah, it was really reassuring to hear that. And obviously I never did go back, but.
Did you have to like relocate your family to the Isle of Man?
We actually did not. For the first 2 years, 2.5 years that I worked for PokerStars, I worked from my home office in California. And then once they opened the office in Isle of Man, Isai, you know, literally found me on MSN and says, okay, you have to move to the Isle of Man. And I was like, well, you know, I don't have to move the Isle of Man. I did not work for PokerStars, but we had made the decision that at that point, our one son was graduated from college and the other one was in college. And so I was like, okay, we'll go for it. And, you know, we moved to the Isle of Man.
And how do you like it there?
Well, so that was in 2005, and we were there for 2 years. And then I came, you know, then I left PokerStars because I wanted to be back in the States for a while.
Right.
And then, you know, things just got worse and worse in the United States. And, you know, at some point I got back in touch with Isai and said, you know, would you be interested in having me back? And he said, yeah, I would be interested in having you back, but you got to move to the Isle of Man. You know, I've heard that line. So, you know, talked with my wife and we said, yeah, let's go for it. So yeah, you know what? It's pretty cool over here. It's very slow. And you have to settle yourself to a slower pace of life. You know, and basically they roll up the sidewalks at about 6 o'clock in the shopping district. But wow. But it's beautiful. And there's lots, I mean, for outdoor activities, it's hard to beat. And, you know, it's a small community. And I don't know if you guys live in big towns or whatever, but when my wife and I were living in Asheville, I was just like, you know, I never lived in a small town before. I mean, we were living in San Jose, 10th largest city in the United States, and you probably didn't even know that. But, you know, when we moved to Asheville and you started bumping into people at the grocery store or a restaurant downtown, or, you know, Saturday night, everybody would go to see roller derby. Hey, listen, Blue Ridge Roller Girls, they're the best. And so I really kind of dug the small town thing of knowing people and recognizing people and, you know, kind of getting to the point where you go into the indie coffee shop and the woman is already making your drink before you open your mouth. Right. And I mean, that's really cool. And so the Isle of Man is like that. I mean, you see people that, you know, and you bump into people at the restaurants and at the coffee shops, at the gym. So I find that to be really rewarding. And if you want like big city, well, London is a 1 hour flight away and you don't, you know, and there are very few cities in the world that rock harder than London does.
Yeah. What's the old saying? As a man who is tired of London is tired of life.
Samuel Johnson. Well done.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that said, I've never been, but I'm sure I wouldn't get tired of it. No, I never have.
Wow, London is pretty frigging cool.
Yeah.
I was also curious how you got into poker generally. I mean, well before PokerStars, you were already writing poker books, and you know, what's your poker story?
I learned to play poker when I was a little kid. My dad taught us five card draw, five card draw and five card stud, and we used the red, white, and blue plastic chips that you get at the drugstore. We never played for money. I don't even think he ever played for money. It was just something we did. It was just like one of those, you know, or we would play Clue or what, right? You know, it was just like one of those games we played. And then I started playing a little in college. And of course, this is before the big boom. So we were playing with nickels and dimes and quarters. And the funny thing was, the guys I played with used an excuse to drink. And for whatever reason, I never developed a taste for alcohol. So I would always basically clean up in these poker games. And yeah. And I mean, I would win like, I mean, this is gonna sound silly to you guys, but I would often win on a Saturday night $8 or $10. But that was like a pizza and a half.
Yeah, that's real money.
When I was in college. And so it was like real walking around money. So I was like, okay, that was cool. And then after that, I really didn't do anything with it for, I guess, about 10 years. But then I discovered legal poker in San Jose. And that was really when I got serious about it. You know, it was in like the Sunday supplement magazine. And they talked about how people were playing lowball, and there was legal poker for real money going on just right down the road from me.
And when is this? Like what year?
Pardon me?
Like what year is this that you're discovering the poker in California?
85, something like that. It was before Hold'em was legalized.
Okay.
And I tried to do the math. Go ahead.
I was going to ask if Bay 101 existed yet.
No, Bay 101 didn't exist yet. Garden City was the only club in San Jose. Actually, no, there was another club called Sutter's that was up north San Jose, and it was actually Sutter's gaming license that opened Bay 101.
Huh.
But, yeah, there's some California poker history for you. But we were playing in Garden City, and the first game that I played in was $2 single draw limit low ball, ace to five.
Wow.
And it was – hey, wait a minute. We are supposed to have that sound over here for the motorcycle races.
Yeah, sorry. I live in Somerville. It's there's a lot of loudness right outside my window. Sorry.
So yeah, I mean, it was the first real commercial poker game I played in, and I must have watched it for 3 or 4 times before I had the nerves to go down there and actually play. But the thing that I mean, and all these people had obviously been playing lowball since God was a corporal. But what I remember was that when you play lowball or any kind of draw game, the discards go clockwise around the table from the dealer, right? And I was watching, and I just thought, oh, these people must be really good at this game because they've obviously been playing forever. And then I was watching, and I would see them. It would come time for the discards, and people would start discarding just all kind of simultaneously throwing their cards in.
Yeah.
And I thought, right? Exactly. And I thought, well, wait a minute, that guy's giving up information.
Yeah.
That he doesn't have to give up.
This is really funny. I had a very similar experience the first time I ever sat down at the 4080 mix at the Bellagio. And this was in the summer of 2006. And I thought, boy, I've been studying this game really hard, but these people must be so good, And then I go, and then, I'm playing 4080 triple draw, and I'm watching the game, and people are, disgustedly mucking two kings face up out of turn, to show that they got dealt the kings at the wrong time or something like that. And then I thought that maybe they weren't playing perfectly.
Well, exactly. And it was that moment where I just thought, these people don't really necessarily know what they're doing. And I would see people doing things like drawing four. And I thought, I don't really know what I'm doing, but I'm pretty sure that can't be right.
Was it jacks or better to open?
It was low ball. So
I would hope not. Ball. Yeah.
eight to five low ball. They were playing draw elsewhere in the club. But it was by far not the most popular. They maybe had like 30 tables or something like that, and 25 or 26 of those tables would be dealing ace to five low ball with a buck.
Yeah, I think that's a really critical realization for any poker player, any budding poker player to realize, like, I don't have to be good at this. I just have to be better than these knuckleheads.
Right, exactly. And it's when you start spotting the mistakes like that. And as soon as I spotted that sort of fundamental error, I just thought, okay, maybe I have a chance here. I mean, I don't know that I can beat this thing, but maybe I have a chance.
Yeah.
That was also in the days where for $2, and it was actually $1.60. So that means if you gave the waitress $2, you were leaving her a 25% tip. You got the best chocolate milkshake I've ever eaten in my life, and they brought, you know how in a chocolate milkshake they use that big metal canister.
Yeah.
Right. They would bring you the glass and the canister, and then they would basically fill the glass from the canister, and then they would leave the rest of the canister, which was like another half glass. And that was $1.60, and I just thought, "What? You know, whatever. I'll just come sit here."
These people
time,
live like kings.
Exactly. Well, the only downside was is that back then you could smoke, and as a matter of fact, it seemed like mandatory to smoke in the room. And the ceilings at Garden City were extremely low. And you quite literally could not see across the club because of the cigarette smoke. And it's even as I describe it now, it seems impossible that I actually sat and marinated in that stuff for that period of time. But I did.
So that's how you started in poker.
You were also an early participant in like the rec.gambling. It wasn't even a forum. It was a billboard.
It was a Usenet group.
Okay, for the kids in the audience, can you explain what that is?
Yes. Back in the old days, I mean, dinosaurs from the earth. There was a thing called Usenet that had originally come out of the Department of Defense, and they had what were called news groups, and you could get a news group reader, and various sites would basically just mirror the news groups. And they started out as like comp.lang.fortran. So people that were interested in talking about Fortran would go to the computer.languages.fortran newsgroup. And then it kind of spread out into other areas. And there became a rec.whatever for recreation. And then they got rec.gambling for people that were into gambling. And then at some point, I guess we're talking maybe the early 90s here, there was a whole system for voting to create a new news group. And there was a vote for breaking rec.gambling into rec gambling poker and rec gambling blackjack and a couple of others. And that passed. And so that became rec gambling poker. And that's where basically everybody hung out and talked about poker. And it was sort of the first place on the internet where people were talking about poker and actually sort of asking each other questions about, you know, can this be right? Or, you know, can I play pocket sevens if it's raised in front of me? And that sort of question that started to come up.
So this is like 2+2 before there was 2+2.
Exactly. I mean, it was the first place where people were getting together and talking about poker, you know, on the internet. And alongside that, they set up a thing on the internet relay chat, IRC, where somebody wrote a poker server so people could play poker online via IRC. And it was this command line interface that you would send commands saying, you know, I want to raise or I want to fold or I want to call. And there was, and then they had different levels of games, but to get into the high level game, you actually had to win your way up from the low level games. And the people that were playing the high level games, I mean, there's a lot of guys there that are, you know, really serious poker theorists at this point. As a matter of fact, I am pretty sure that Chris Ferguson got his basic understanding of poker theory playing on IRC, and he came along, and there were all these guys that were winning all the IRC tournaments, and Chris Ferguson came along and started crushing the IRC tournaments because he, you know, took all his math chops and applied them to poker.
Yeah. Wow. Are there other names that you met through that forum that we would recognize?
Oh, sure. Tons of them. Andy Block was there. But there was all kinds of people that were Darce Billings, who is sort of the guy who is the I guess I would say the king of AI in the poker world, was one of the early participants there. So yeah, there was a lot of people that were very, very early people talking about poker and stuff like that. And then a couple of people who've kind of just vanished off the face of the earth. And the one that I always wonder about is a guy named Michael Hall, who was actually quite literally, he worked at NASA. I mean, he was a rocket scientist. and he quit to play blackjack and poker full time. And he actually did some of the early, and he was doing a lot of the posting on RGP, Rec Gambling Poker. And, you know, really trying to think hard about the theory of poker and how things actually worked and stuff like that. And then he was one an early poster on 2+2. And then he and Mason got into a big spat, and he eventually just either got thrown off of 2+2 or abandoned it. I don't remember what the story was, but, you know, and then he's just kind of vanished into the ether. And I've always wondered what happened to Michael.
Well, his son Galen has been kicking ass.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So we're talking now about how far poker has come. But one thing we've talked about on the podcast a lot is in some ways how far poker hasn't come. So we've talked about misogyny and sexism and heteronormativity and a basic disregard for mental health issues and things like that in poker, and some of these social issues. It seems pretty clear that we have a ways to go, like collectively. How do you see, like, what do you see as some of the challenges in that department? And do you see it getting better? And if so, how?
I would say that in some areas it's certainly getting better. You know, there's been some really amazing breakthroughs, I would say, in the last year or two. You look at Jason Somerville coming out and people going, you know, right on. And you look at the acceptance of Vanessa Selps. But I mean, the thing about Vanessa is that she is just such a beast.
Yeah.
And the poker community, I mean, they know one of their own, right? And yeah. I can remember seeing Vanessa on the EPT, and we're talking like 2006, 2007. And she just, I mean, she just like hung out with one of the guys, and it's because she is such a poker player, and she's so frightening as a poker player, and she parties harder than, you know, most of those guys could in their dreams. So it's like, she was just a perfect fit. And they're like, okay, so she's a lesbian. Like, so what? Right. I mean, she's one of us.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know Jason, so I don't know how he fits in, but I have the impression that he again is just another poker guy. They're kind of like, you know, okay, fine, you know, you like your thing and we like ours and it's all good. And I think that's a really healthy attitude. But the fact of the matter is that the demographic of poker is 18 to 34 year old males. And that's not necessarily the most socially well-established and well-adjusted group running around the planet. Mm-hmm. And you know, I used to be an 18 to 34 year old male, and it was not a pretty sight. So I'm not putting anybody down. I'm just saying that's the demographic. And there is certainly a component of poker and the gambling and the emotional high that people get from that attracts people that are, you know, looking for highs in other ways. And there's not much you're going to do about that. Okay. I don't think that you can ever really divorce those two. And those of us that kind of look at poker as entertainment, as something to do, and don't confuse it with a lifestyle, or those of us that look at it as a profession. And again, you know, it's, when you start thinking poker as a lifestyle, I think you're getting into trouble. You can see it as entertainment. You can see it as a social outlet where you get to meet cool people. You can see it as an opportunity to travel and, you know, go to the EPTs and the Latin American Poker Tour and the PCA and all those amazing things and have a great time. You can see it as a profession where you make money. You can see it as an intellectual challenge where you just try to get smarter about something, or you learn something, or you just develop a new technique or whatever it is. That's all good. When you start thinking about it as a lifestyle, I think you're headed down a dangerous path.
Is that because you think that poker is unsuitable for being a lifestyle, or is it because you think there is some poker lifestyle, like of the sort that the World Series used to put on Showcase, disturbingly enough, for a week right, every year? Exactly. I used to always get a dark chuckle out of that. Like, boy, if you're actually aiming to get to it was called that, right? The Poker Lifestyle Convention?
It was the Poker Lifestyle Expo, right?
And it was like, boy, you don't want to go out of your way to try to adopt that. But I did get a Gus Hansen card protector for free 1 year. So, yeah.
Exactly. But yeah, yeah, I mean, I think that – go ahead.
So I guess my question was, is it something about the activity of poker that makes it unsuitable for a person to turn into a lifestyle? Or is it because you think there's one culture out there, like the sort of thing that the World Series was trying to promote, that is unhealthy? There's like one specific thing that people get drawn to in an unhealthy way, and that's unsuitable for. Yeah.
I think that the lifestyle that people try to, you know, that some people that are looking to make a buck describe as the poker lifestyle is pretty shallow, pretty empty, and pretty dangerous.
Okay.
That's the best way I would describe it. I mean, if there's anything, yeah, I'll just leave it at that. I just think that the quote poker lifestyle is not something that I would advocate really for anybody. And you know, I mean, look at the series of posts that Greg Merson has done, right? The guy who won the World Series this year,
yeah,
and talked about his problems with drugs and everything.
Yeah.
And I thought that just showed incredible courage and just amazing fortitude on his part to just come out and say that. I don't know that I could say do that. But I am really delighted to see people such as him, such as Jason Somerville, just, you know, say, this is who I am. And yeah, I'm a poker player, but there's something deeper in me that matters.
That's a good way of putting it.
You know,
when you mention the demographic of poker being the 18 to 34 year old males, it seems to me that Poker Stars is making a pretty active effort to, I don't know about to change that. I mean, it seems like maybe that'll always be the core demographic, but I mean, it's pretty obvious that Poker Stars is making a real attempt to appeal more to female players or to draw in more women. Is that anything that you've been involved with at Poker Stars?
I haven't been directly involved in it, but I am 145% behind it. I mean, I think that we have to get away from the attitude that poker is only for the grinders and for the would-be grinders and for that type. I mean, there's a huge group of people out there. I mean, I think that poker is a wonderful game. I love the game. And I can actually, I'm I think I may be in the minority of among serious poker players, but I can play poker for no money and have a great time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as long as I'm playing with people that are taking the game seriously.
Yeah.
There doesn't have to be real money involved. And the thing is that I'm sure you guys go and play, you know, Trivial Pursuit or Clue or Bridge or, you know, whatever the game is with your friends, and there's no money involved. And everybody tries to win because the point is winning. And there's a lot of people that play poker for exactly that same reason, that there's no money involved, and they don't want money to be involved because they don't want to risk their money because they don't think they're good enough, which is a perfectly legitimate way, you know, approach.
Of course.
And I think we have to serve that marketplace.
Hence the home games.
Because that basically, well, hence home games and hence, you know, we do have these tournaments that are for women only. You know, and like the big kerfuffle that they have about the women's tournament at the World Series every year, right? I think there is nothing better than letting a bunch of women get together and play poker. And all this stuff about, you know, it's reverse discrimination, blah, blah, blah. That's ridiculous.
Word.
It means that a woman can sit down at the table and not have some guy staring at her boobs the whole time. That's really what it means.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do feel like literally every time I've played with a female player, like some comment has been made about her gender. I mean, sometimes it's more innocuous, just like, oh, I'll fold the little lady, but, you know, they've seen some pretty inappropriate stuff too.
Right, exactly. And I'm sure you've seen times when it was a whole lot less appropriate than that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And so my attitude is, you know, and I used to kind of feel that way about the women's tournaments, is like, you know, let them come compete like everybody else. And because there is no reason, that's the cool thing about poker, is there is no physical component to this, right? You know, but once I thought about it for about 15 minutes, I went, oh, duh. You know, it's incredibly intimidating. And the air of testosterone in the table can be just overwhelming. And, you know, no woman wants to sit down in that environment. Or very few do. So, you know, I think the opportunity for women to play with other women, and, you know, and if you go watch the ladies tournament at the World Series of Poker, they have more fun than all the rest of the tournaments put together.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's something there. Okay. So yeah, I think it's really important that, I mean, I know PokerStars is going after women in, and I think as a demographic, women and older people, and, you know, that see this game as fun, entertainment, and challenge. You know, we need to make those people part of the party.
Is that, I mean, is there like a political element to that, or is it just good business? Like you want more customers, and that's an untapped demographic, or do you see it as like it's really important to have more women playing poker for some external reason?
It's just plain business. You know, if you make the game bigger and more popular, and you know, everybody enjoys it more, and it just becomes more accepted around the world, then that's just good business.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking, we had Vanessa Selbstone here a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking with her some about issues of, you know, inequality and sexism and whatnot in the poker world. And I think the consensus that we sort of reached was that it was a problem, but that there were more important battlegrounds, you know, that those things were a problem in a lot of places, and it was more important to address those sorts of things in like the workplace, or as in the poker world was just not the most important place to be concerned with social equality issues. But I'm wondering now, you know, when you talk about all these really smart people who were drawn to the rec.gambling forums in the early days, and, you know, literally rocket scientists and computer scientists. And we know that, you know, it has generally been Nate Silver is another good example, just people for whom poker seems to have been part of an intellectual development that led to them doing really impressive things outside of the poker world. I wonder if there is some element of like mental training that you get from poker that it would be good if there were a larger demographic of people exposed to that.
Well, actually, it's really interesting you should say that. I wrote a blog piece for a website that I'll just won't even mention right now, but it was called "Would I Teach My Kids to Play Poker?" And it was, and somebody had brought it up on like, I don't know, 2+2 or something like that. And the reason that I wrote the piece was because I did in fact teach my sons to play poker. because I think poker, and not because I ever wanted them to take poker seriously, and thank God they never did, but because I think poker has enormous lessons to teach about life and, you know, and weighing risk and reward and, you know, essentially doing pot odds calculations of things that you do in your life, or you say, or the problem that you have throughout life of dealing with incomplete information when you make a decision about some important aspect of your life. And it can, you know, for a lot of people, they are just sort of naturally inclined to want to have every bit of information possible before they make a decision. And it can be very valuable to learn that sometimes you just have to make a decision without complete information, and you make the best decision you can. And then you go forward and you accept the fact that you may or may not have made the best decision, but you made the best decision you could in the context of the information that you had, and you'd be satisfied with that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think there's enormous value to be gained from poker, and as Nate Silver's star just, you know, skyrockets up into the sky, it's going to be interesting if he ever declones as a poker player, right?
Right.
Yeah. So, oh my God, Nate Silver's setting up my poker table. Yeah, what yeah. do you know? Get him it's on your right, dude.
So, I mean, you talked about life lessons you get from poker, and you mentioned some of the technical ones, like the value of information and sometimes the cost of information, and it can be a mistake to pay or wait for more information, and balancing risk and reward. For me, I think almost the psychological ones, the more purely psychological ones, were more important. Things like learning how to get your butt kicked a lot and just lose a lot, even if you're good, even if you're an overall winner, you just lose a lot in dealing with that. Do you have any sense? I mean, was that something that was like on your mind as you're teaching your sons to play poker? Do you think that that's something that poker teaches people effectively? Or is it just, I think Andrew and I have talked about this on air before, and I think I come out thinking that poker is in some ways a more effective vehicle than Andrew does. And Andrew thinks that he got some of these things from other things in poker, then applied them to poker. I mean, where do you come in on that?
Well, I think if you're good, I mean, it is true that if you can, that poker is a very humbling experience, no matter how good you are at it. But I think if you're really going to get that lesson, you have to play a whole lot, and you almost have to be professional about it, and you have to be taking it so seriously that you're tracking your results with hold'em manager and everything else, and sort of just agonizing through these, you know, 10, 20, 50, 100 buy-in downswings. But I do think, as a matter of fact, it's something I wrote in a blog piece, was that poker is really good at teaching you to deal with bad beats in life and to sort of accept them as part of life, and to accept them that it's not life out to get you, you know? And it's really, and let me give you that the thing is that life deals everybody bad beats. And sometimes they're small ones, and then sometimes they're just, you know, they're just kind of life shattering. And it can sort of make you feel that the world is out to get you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the best lessons you can take away from poker is the world in general doesn't care about you any more than it cares about, you know, any more than the deck cares about the next card that peels off.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I don't know if that can be any consolation whatsoever when, you know, your kid's best friend is at school is killed in a car crash or something. But I mean, I think maybe it helps us somehow frame life's bad beats as just the inexorable movement of fate. Mm-hmm. And there's just nothing you can do about it, and you just have to learn to deal with that. And yeah. You can't scream. I mean, you know, you have to suffer through it, but you can't take it personally. Life is not out to get you. And it's very interesting because I don't know where you guys are politically, but I was rooting hard for the Democrats on last Tuesday. And, you know, my wife was before as the evening, you know, we went into the election, and Nate at 5:38 was saying, okay, Obama just, and he almost used exactly these words. He basically just, Obama has to fade a gut shot. I don't know if you saw that on 5:38. He literally said, he said Romney is drawing to an inside straight, right?
Yeah.
And the funny thing was, is that a lot of people, they look at that 91.6% or whatever it was, because Nate, it was like pretty much down to the decimal place that Romney was drawing it four outs, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of people saw that 91% whatever, and they said, you know, we're home free.
Yeah.
And every poker player that I knew that was online with me was could think of every single time they've seen four outs. Don't talk to me about four outers. I've seen two outers. Don't. Yeah. This is not over yet.
Yeah.
Get the damn river card out there.
Yeah. I mean, most people enter tournaments, and are rational to do so with that percent chance of not cashing. Like, the whole activity is built around experiencing right. something that's less probable than that.
Exactly. You know, that's the whole point. And so it was really interesting to me to see how poker players were just, we were just biting our nails.
Yeah.
You know, we saw Chris Ferguson hit a three out against TJ Cloutier in 2001. This stuff happens.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh yeah.
And that didn't matter. This matters.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, no matter which side of the fence you're on, it matters, right? So, like,
exactly. Yeah. Oh, exactly. I mean, this was a big deal for a whole lot of people in America and around the world, whichever side of the fence you were on. But yeah, it's. I think that to me is one really the value. I don't know if that's a lesson that poker teaches you, or how I should couch that, because it certainly caused a certain amount of. You know, I think people that don't think about poker and don't think about gut shots probably were more sanguine about the way things were going to go than those poker players.
Yeah. I mean, I know for myself, one of my big eye-opening aha moments was when I was talking to somebody about eye surgery. I'm nearsighted. I've never had LASIK or anything. And part of it was that I had read things where there's, at the time, it was something like a 1% chance of either going blind or having serious eye damage from an eye surgery. But it looked like there was a good chance that it was going to get down to maybe a third of a percent later. And I remember talking to somebody and saying, boy, you know, that's a really big difference. And I think I definitely at least want to wait until it's like a third of a percent. That really makes a big difference to me. And the person thought I was crazy. Like, what's the difference between a third of a percent and 1%, you know? And, well, I mean, you think about the utility of your eyesight, you know, and I mean, that's a real, I mean, it matters a lot. And it also matters for things like policy, you know, it matters a lot if the debt is $16 billion or $16 trillion, you know, like, and I think poker sensitizes you to some of these small probabilities and large numbers, yeah, and things like that.
No, it's very interesting. And I totally agree. And that, I think that was one of the things that I really worked hard with my sons was, you know, in kind of the risk reward model of understanding utility.
Yeah.
And, you know, and particularly in kind of some of these long shot things, you know, like, I mean, actually I wrote about it in that blog piece where, you know, where we talked about safe sex. Maybe there's a really low chance of you getting some dread disease, but guess what? The cost is incalculable.
Yeah.
So yeah. You just, you know, this is stuff you don't play around with.
Yeah. Wait till you're out of the car before you make that phone call or send that text message, you know. That's
yeah, exactly, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. That's exactly what it's like.
Yeah.
So you don't encourage people using the PokerStars mobile client while they're behind the wheel.
Please. I assume it's illegal in most states and in most places in most jurisdictions around the world. I sure hope it is.
Yeah. Well, I guess, I mean, I know I could ask you questions all night, but we should probably let you get back to your life at some point here.
Thanks again for coming on, Lee. It's been a real interesting guy to talk to.
I've really enjoyed this because, I mean, I have to say that you guys ask a lot of questions and cover a lot of topics that are very different from most of the ones that I get. And I actually find it far more interesting to talk about. I mean, poker is a great game, but a lot of times the implications of the game and where it goes and where it takes us, you know, societally and things like that are much more interesting than, you know, like, so what do you think of that final table play where he called with Queen Jack? You know, like, whatever.
Yeah. That's actually why this podcast exists. On episode one, we basically said exactly that. It's the nicest thing you could have said to us, because that's exactly what we're trying to do with this show. So
yeah. And actually, could we end maybe with you making a couple predictions about where you see poker going, since you brought that up?
I actually, one of my rules is that I don't make predictions like that. You know, it's like I am no Nate, you know, I know Nate Silver, and son, you're no Nate Silver. I really don't know where it's going to go.
Where would you like to see it go?
Where would I like to see it go? I would like to see it get a wider base of popularity among more people, that it lose kind of its stigma of being a backroom game. And it's certainly gotten so much better than when I first got into the game. I can't even begin to describe it. I mean, it was, you know, when I first got into poker, like everybody, if you played against somebody who had an English accent, they called him London. I mean, seriously, I mean, that was the kind of world we live in. So things have come a long, long way. But I would love to see poker just become something like soccer/football or bridge, or, you know, I mean, bridge unfortunately has basically died, which is too bad because it's a great game, or chess, you know, where people just play the game, and they, you know, and it's a family game. If you think about it, poker is far more suited to family games than, say, bridge or chess, because you can have all kinds of different numbers of people play, and it has this nice little very small granular unit, which is one hand.
Yeah.
Which means that you can play for, you know, 15 minutes or an hour, 3 hours, or, you know, till he passes out, you know, whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
So I think I would just like to see poker just become something that people enjoy on all kinds of levels, for money or not for money, and where it becomes something where it's like, okay, this is a great game, and there's all kinds of cool intellectual and psychological challenges, and it does teach wonderful life lessons, as we've discussed, and let's just accept it for that. And oh, by the way, yeah, some people play for money, and just leave it at that. Just like, you know, like people go out and play soccer, and they have a great time playing soccer, and there's no money involved, but they love playing soccer. And then there's some guys that get paid, you know, $250,000 a week to go play soccer.
Yeah, right. Golf maybe is people even – all sorts of people play it. Sure. And all sorts of other people bet $100,000 on a hole or whatever. So that's
– right.
Maybe not all sorts of people, but some people do.
But all sorts of people bet $20 on a hole or –
Yeah, exactly.
Right. But I mean, I think I don't know this, but I mean, I assume that there's a whole lot of people out playing golf that never put a single dime. They're just playing golf.
Yeah. And it's a perfectly intelligible game without money being attached to it. That's
exactly. And I think poker is a perfectly intelligible game without money being attached to it. And that's what I would like to see. Is I guess the short version of this is that I would like to see poker in some ways divorced from the money, and just to be a really cool game. And then, and oh, by the way, there's people that play the game for money.
Cool. Well, I think you're definitely doing more than your part to accomplish that goal. And I do think it's an admirable goal.
Thank you. I appreciate that a whole lot.
Thank you for coming on.
Thanks very much. And have a good evening over there.
It's been a blast. You guys take care.
You too.
Thank you very much. Well, good stuff from Lee. That was it was a principle of our podcast that we would always get guests that are too good for us.
Yeah, what a cool guy.
Anyone who can be serious, both when he's talking about how hard London rocks and when he's talking about how cool it is to have a Fortran Usenet group, is okay in my book.
Yeah, he's probably one of the coolest. I don't know if he was a computer scientist, but I mean, he was working in Silicon Valley and whatnot. I mean, probably one of the coolest computer geeks on the planet.
Did anything that he said jump out at you as?
Yeah, you know, the thing that I remember, and it's not really a disagreement, I just think it's not true for me. The bit about, you know, poker can be a perfectly interesting game when you're not playing for money, I think it's really hard. I mean, it's true that it can be when you're not playing for money. Like, I've definitely played with people who are very serious about poker for stakes that were like trivial or you know, no money involved at all. And when they're also good poker players, it's fine. But I've also played in circumstances, you know, and this hasn't happened in a couple of years because now I just avoid these situations entirely. But, you know, especially you just have like a friend or somebody who's like, oh, hey, let's have a poker party. And it's a bunch of people who don't know how to play poker, and either you're not playing for money or you're playing for what are, I mean, probably to all of us, very small stakes, but like,
yeah,
obviously, you know, for someone who's played for, you know, the kind of money that a professional does in particular, it's quite small stakes. And there's just no way for me to, like, I can't just not play well, you know, like it's not fun or interesting to me to like play every hand or like just play randomly or semi-randomly the way like a bunch of other people who know nothing about poker and aren't trying to play well are going to play. There's no way that I can be an equal participant in that game.
How would you play if not well? I mean, by what principle would you choose your actions?
That's why I say randomly. Like I would just do stuff for no reason. Which,
yeah, I mean, something about the game is that people play badly because there's a certain amount of intrigue and fun in just seeing what happens in playing every hand of the river.
Yeah, but you know, obviously, I sound like a jaded asshole, but I've seen it all. You know. Like,
yeah, exactly.
I've lost quads to quads. I don't think I've ever lost straight flush to straight flush, but I've lost quads to quads. You know, I've seen just about everything. Or certainly, I'm not going to see anything in a super small stakes home game that I've never seen.
I mean, certainly the seeing whether or not a flush comes in carries no intrinsic pleasure anymore.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you can't really be with people in the same place. Like, it's just we're not doing the same thing, and there's no way that I can like turn that off and play casually. And I think that's probably true of some things. I mean, I'm not much of a chess player, but I imagine that would be relatively true for someone who's good at chess. It would just be sort of boring or trivial or something to play with someone who's not good. But I think there are, like, I mean, sports is a good example. I think there are a lot of people who enjoy playing sports, and they'll enjoy playing against people who aren't as good also. You're even on a totally different level than they are. I mean, I guess they're still not in the same place exactly, but it seems different to me, like, to play sports with your kid as opposed to playing poker with your kid.
I do think it's possible to play poker without there being money there. I think having a tournament can help, because there's some other, you know, you have some goal to seek, and there's some single large winning event that you can chase.
You know, I did learn poker playing those family games in the same way that Lee described. I mean, I was probably like 7 years old or something when a relative taught me how to play. I think I started on 7-card stud, but 5-card draw was also a game I learned pretty early. And I did used to play for pennies, really probably all the way through high school with my father's side of the family anyway, with my grandparents and my dad and my brother. We would often, I usually saw them like once a week. My grandparents would go to their house for dinner, and often we'd play some sort of game afterwards. Monopoly was popular also, but poker was pretty common.
Yeah, I mean, I got introduced to poker by my father. Let's see, what else do we talk about? Getting women involved. It seemed to be a sort of tacit premise in what he was saying, that women would be more likely to want to play poker for no money. I'm not totally sure that's true, but that's
it. Yeah, I mean, I think there are, like, I mean, I'm real uncomfortable on principle with saying stuff like, you know, this is how women are and this is how men are, or I think essentialism is the term, that like the kind of academic term that would be used for this, to say like, you know, women think like this and men think like this, or women have these preferences and men have these preferences. So I mean, you probably wouldn't want to state it quite that strongly, but I mean, I imagine there are, I believe I've seen studies suggesting that like women as a whole tend to be more risk averse than men, and tend to get more uncomfortable in situations where like something of value is being risked.
Okay.
So I can understand why. I mean, obviously there are, I mean, Vanessa Supps is a great example of an exception to that rule, but so I mean, there are plenty of exceptions, but I can understand why if you're just saying, you know, what's a barrier to women's involvement in poker, I can understand why for some category of women, the introduction of money being wagered just creates an uncomfortable situation. I think that would be true, for instance, of my mother.
I see. Again to Lee Jones, and also to all our listeners. If you get us through iTunes and are so inclined, please rate and review us there. We love to get feedback. Please email us at podcast@thinkingpoker.net. Music this week comes from Monogold, who you can check out at monogold.bandcamp.com, where you can buy their latest album, The Softest Glow. Until next Monday, have a great week.